Welcome to the Working Dog Depot podcast with your hosts, Rich Harden and Howard Young.
Good evening, Howard Young. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Trying to stay warm in the great state of Kentucky. You know, 23 degrees, ice this morning. Yeah, just a crappy day all around.
Well, it's 56 here today. It's rainy, but it's 56.
Yeah, well, I'll take the 56 and rain over this one. It was pretty nasty this morning.
Yeah, we're pretty much not going to get much of a winter, which is fine. We did get that cold snap a few weeks ago where the weather tried to kill us, but we're probably not going to get much in the way of snow, if at all.
Well, that wouldn't hurt my feelings. We really can't count today's snow. It's just ice. It's got a little slushy last night and all froze over this morning, so it's pretty treacherous. But it's like it's clearing up, so we'll see.
So we're coming off our second trip to Philadelphia. We spent the whole week together last week instructing, and this focus of this trip was actually scent detection. And actually, the week went really fast from my perspective.
It flew by. You know, we have 26, 27 teams up there imprinting dogs, and I think I had 11 or 12 trained teams that we set up some detection scenarios for, introduced them to some new things, showed some leash handling. I think seemed to go very well. It seemed to be very receptive to what we had to offer, and I think it was a good week.
Most definitely. You know, I wanted to stress this again to the whole group before we left, and that is to say that really the purpose of these trips obviously is continuing education or furthering education, and it's to really help them have some additional tools in their tool belt. If you like that analogy, I think a lot of people use that analogy. It's a good one. It's not to go say that they're doing anything wrong, but here are some things to consider. We made some adjustments while we were there.
Oh, I think as soon as any trainer or any person that's putting on any type of course says, this is the absolute way to do anything, I think you set yourself up for failure, because not every dog will fit into your program. And being able to switch gears and show a dog a different picture is a definite way to make yourself a better trainer. And, you know, hats off to them for inviting us up and learning new things. And, you know, some of it is new to them. And I think they're very receptive. And I'm like you, hopefully they run across a couple of problems later on with their training and or a dog that's not catching on, that they have another avenue to approach that issue with. And that's really what becoming a good dog trainer is all about.
Sure. You can take a square peg and ram it into a round hole. Just not supposed to work that way.
Oh, I've done it. Yeah, I've done it. So absolutely. but there's better ways. And when you know, as a younger trainer, I've done it, of course. But
sure, just having that, you know, just get a bigger hammer.
Yeah. You know, having a different frame of reference to go, oh, okay, this is an issue I've addressed in the past, and now I have a new tool to see if it works, is a whole lot better than just starting that hammer in the hole again. So I completely agree.
So we have talked about doing this episode. We don't have a special guest coming in, but what we've done is gathered some questions from some of our listeners in various places to do kind of an informal question and answering session.
Yeah, I think it was really cool for folks to reach out and drop some questions, and hopefully we can give them some information. You know, of course, these are our opinions, and, you know, by no stretch of the imagination do we think we know everything, but hopefully we can give you some decent answers to these questions.
Yes. So the first question has to do with utilizing hidden sleeves and prosthetics for canines. How often, positives, negatives? But first, I think before we even begin that question or answering that question, we need to talk about what those things are. I think, you know, you hear that and what is that? So, I mean, looking at it from the very beginning, dogs get very connected, or they form a strong association with equipment. And we all know that bad guys don't wear equipment. So if you have a dog that is sleeve happy, meaning that they visually, they're very motivated by the sight of a sleeve, or they're very motivated by the sight of a bite suit, that in and of itself does not guarantee that your dog is going to do the job that you want it to do in a real situation.
Right. I agree.
So ultimately what we're doing is we're working toward creating a picture, and we use this analogy all the time, and that is that dogs need to be exposed to certain pictures in order for them to understand their task. So we can't always use these big bulky sleeves, big bulky suits. Visually, the dogs get very motivated by them. So we have to work toward a picture that resembles something that an ordinary person would wear, just plain clothes. And there's lots of little tricks and gimmicks. And some of those things are hidden sleeves, which, you know, are sleeves that are low profile enough that you could wear under clothing. And then there's some kind of a cool product out there, which resembles a prosthetic, which I guess technically is a prosthetic, which would be a rubber arm or rubber leg. And people have utilized those, or they're available to use to help bridge that gap or create that picture. And, you know, we can talk about what are the positives, what are the negatives. I have my own thoughts, and I'm curious what yours are.
Well, you know, personally, I'm not knocking them. I don't think they don't come without some sort of value. I think it will show a different picture. You don't have the big suit. You can hide them, you know, but if over time, if you're using these things on any type of regular basis, if you don't think the dog understands that there's a sleeve involved or something smells different, then, you know, you're crazy. For me, it's all about the muzzle. If I really want to know if my dog bites for real, I don't mind using these as bridges to them. And I think, again, they have some value, but I like the muzzle where it takes away all equipment and the dog gets no satisfaction. Then I know for sure if he will bite.
Right. Yeah. My thing about the hidden sleeves and also the prosthetics, it's all about the setup. If the dog is seeing that picture over and over, look, we're dealing with masters of association. They make the connection, whether it's through visual, which I think a lot of times it is visual, but it could also be through scent. They see the subtle differences in that one arm that's slightly larger than the other. We also, as decoys, try to be as natural as we can. Self-preservation at some point kicks in, and you're gonna flag that, or you're gonna bring that arm up. Of course, one argument could be is that, you know, an individual that is about to get bit may do the same thing. But we are creatures of habit, and we have our own. We present things a particular way over and over again to the dog, and they make that connection very quickly. I think on the positive also is that it is a different surface. So some of the sleeves that are really low profile, the dog has to physically really get the feel of that arm in there because there's not a lot of squishy material. But again, it's all about the presentation. And you can set these situations up so that you trick the dog, but you're really only tricking him one time.
Right. I agree that you can show there. It's not a huge tug toy. Like, you know, some places have an oversized bite suit and really, they're not really biting the person. They're biting material. And, you know, not like some of those semi-comp suits or competition suits where the dog has to get up and in on those bites hard. So that I like those much better. And I think this allows that to happen on that short-term basis that you just said. I'm going to trick you, but it's only going to trick you once.
Not to say that you shouldn't use them. I've seen some pretty cool presentations of the prosthetic too, where the dog is working down along a wall and the first thing it encounters is that rubber arm or rubber leg, and it looks very natural. But again, once that happens, it's the game is up.
Yeah, I think it's good to proof what you're doing with them. I'm not going to knock them all the way around, of course, but you know, personally, when people talk about, again, if my dog's going to bite for real, I want to see all the equipment go away and him not be able to get any satisfaction. And then we know for sure, you know, unless we just send them on people for live bites, for me, that's the surefire way to know if my dog's going to actually engage somebody or not.
Right. All right.
All right. Question number two, general thoughts on protection dogs.
Man, you could go down a rabbit hole on that one.
Yeah, you sure can. You sure can. Well, I, you know, personally, we brought this up before, that when you talk about protection dogs, if the first question out of your mouth is, what is your personal protection plan and how we're going to build that dog around your plan, then I think it's a bust. Anybody that says these dogs are the end all be all of anything, to me, that's a used car salesman. That's a lie, and it's not going to work for you when you need it to work. So that's just my opinion. So protection dogs, you know, I guess we'll start, I guess this question, you know, there's different levels of protection dogs, whether it's civil aggression or dogs that will fully engage. And these are things that, you know, people need to sit down with their perspective vendor that they're getting the dog from and ask the right questions. You know, I have a family. Do I really want this dog to bite, or do I want it just to have a show? Are we going to be able to build that into what we think is important in our protection plan? And so that piece of the puzzle gets built around my family's plan. And then I think I have a better chance of being successful in those scenarios.
I agree. I think that the hard conversation is the one that you have with the owner that centers around the fact that the dog is could possibly be your opportunity to create distance, space, time to get away.
Sure.
Ultimately. And I think the idea of having a protection dog without really going down and answering or asking and answering all of the hard questions. And there are a lot of hard questions. And what are the characteristics that need to be present? I trained one this past year, and it was just an absolutely great experience. And the fact that it was such a great experience makes me think, do I really want to do that again? because things just played out very nicely. It was the right dog to the right people, the right family. The dog is just, you know, phenomenally open and social in most cases, as he needs to be because of their lifestyle. I think that, you know, from the perspective of a deterrent, you know, there's that aspect as well. And I think that, you know, that deterrent you have to live with every day. You know, if you get a protection dog and it ends up in a kennel, what do you really have?
Dog's hard. It's hard for the dog to protect you if it's living in a crate. That's right.
Right.
So, you know, of course there's plans that you can build around that as well, but and you have to know what you have. And I think what you brought up is that the dog has to fit the lifestyle of the people, and folks looking for a protection dog have to understand that this is not a hobby. It's a lifestyle when you do this. And if you're not bought into the lifestyle, then that dog's just going to be a hindrance to you.
Right. Yeah. I could see that happening with some folks, is that it's the new shiny thing, and mm-hmm. it's getting the lion's share of attention. And then that gets old, and they realize that there's a lot of responsibility and care and maintenance that goes along with that. And then it's like, I just don't want to be bothered today.
Well, you know, there's so many nightmares out there, people getting dogs. You know, these some of these folks will get a KMPV dog out of Holland and pick it up and then just turn around and sell it right back to a client without any other training. The dog's not housebroken, and you know, you're spending thousands and thousands of dollars that a dog just craps in the middle of your floor. And I think you just need to be careful. If someone that's looking for a personal protection dog, you really need to do your homework. You need to look at the vendor, talk to people that's gotten dogs from that vendor, and make sure that it's going to fit your needs, and try to ask all the right questions.
Yeah, I think that was the aspect that I don't think I underestimated it. I knew that it was going to be a significant portion of the training time, and that was that the dog had to be he had to be housebroken, and he couldn't be a counter surfer. All those types of things that have to be, you know, he has to fit well in the home. And then obviously when you introduce the dog to the family, you need to take several days to help them understand how all this works and make sure that the dog is getting along with everyone. There's just a lot involved. And you're right. There are some scam artists out there, obviously, that are out to make a quick buck. But I imagine there are some good ones as well. It's the price is what it is. The price is what people are willing to pay. Right.
Sure. And if you're looking for a true protection dog, you're gonna pay a dollar or two for sure. It's not gonna be.
There are people that want to pay that kind of money. They have it. They want to spend it. Can you justify it? I guess you can. I mean,
well, again, depending on the question. I think the biggest thing is people don't know what they don't know, and they don't do enough research or talk to enough people to make sure they're not going down a road that's gonna set them up for failure instead of success.
I think the one thing, though, that I do want to mention, and I've seen this in a few occasions, is that the protection dog is not a service dog.
It is not.
You cannot put a vest on that dog and call it a service dog. You know, we had a whole episode about service dogs. And, you know, when I hear folks doing that, that is such a disservice.
It absolutely is.
And it could be potentially disastrous.
It could be. Absolutely. Be careful. I'm just going to put out my buyer beware statement once again. Be careful where you go and who you're talking to.
This episode of the Working Dog Depot podcast is brought to you by our title sponsor, Fox and Hound. Fox and Hound has spent years creating the perfect formulas that are safe for our pups and contain many natural ingredients. They develop the highest quality products for all dogs and products for all dog lovers and their homes. Products range from scented candles to dog shampoo, flea and tick spray, stain remover, paw balm, and dog cologne. They've even developed a line for working dogs and their handlers. For you folks who are required to wear a vest while on duty, you should check out their vest spray. Folks, the Young Home has Fox and Hound products in every room. For me, it's really quite simple. The products are great, and they're made by great people. Order online at shopfoxandhound.com or follow an order on Instagram at shopfoxandhound. For a 15% discount, use the WDDP discount code. Remember, man's best friend deserves dog's best products. So the next question, how would you go about teaching a dog that has low possession to remain engaged during a passive bite? Now, I don't know whether this if this is a actual dog that is engaging a physical bite, there are a lot of red flags from my perspective. But if it's muzzle, that's a different question altogether.
Yeah, well, so I think it doesn't – I think we're going to get rid of low possession. And, you know, we talk about that prey gets the dog to the bite, right? So the need to chase and vanquish. So prey gets us there, and decoys stay in prey drive. If you watch all these cool videos – some of these dog trainers out there, you know, they got some great Instagram videos where they're working the dog and driving the dog, and it's all about prey. And the dog stays engaged and looks great. So when you look at a passive bite, for me, what that says is, you know, you have a guy that's or girl that's not giving them any prey, that's either laying down, that's standing in a corner, that's not giving them any movement for that prey. So, you know, you can teach this. So the dog engages with prey, and you go a little passive. He pushes, you come alive again, right? You go dead, he pushes, you go alive again. And then you just increase that time that of the passivity in that bite. And then over time, he will do a passive bite if he's not got, you know, if he's never done it before. Sometimes you get a beast and you don't have that issue, but that's how we built it.
Right.
And how we still continue to build the passive bite.
I agree. That's how I do it as well. I think, you know, I make this statement, or I've made this statement many, many times. I'm not so concerned for the officers that I work with about the guy or the ability of the dog to engage with the person who's running away. That's prey.
Yes.
And dogs understand prey. At least the dogs that we work with understand prey. They may not understand passive engagement. And those are the situations that I'm most concerned about, their safety and the dog understanding that picture. Because I would say, without doing the math, probably 80% or more of the engagements that the guys that I work with have are on passive individuals. Typically at the end of a track or in a building, they come upon somebody that is trying to evade capture, and they're laying on the ground passively, or the dogs have to understand. And if it's on the ground and it's passive, it's fair game.
Sure. And I think, you know, I left the police department in 2011, and you know, most people didn't stand out in front of the dog, hitting their arm like a sleeve, Sam, come get me. They ran away and hid. So, you know, teaching a dog to bite passively is very, very important, especially a police dog, military dog, you know, multi-purpose canines. They need to have that skill taught to them. And, you know, again, adding it in there little by little and over time, staying passive longer and longer will teach your dog just to come and crush a bite when no one's moving. And they have to be taught that.
Right.
And I think that kind of goes into our next question. It's talking about police dog selection. What abilities, trained or genetic, should the dog possess to justify the cost? What sets them apart as far as selection is concerned? And that's a lot in a question.
That is a lot in a question. So, you know, right off the bat, one of the things that stands out is that dog has to be sound environmentally. He can't have issues with slick floors, strange, you know, uncommon objects. Those are the things to me that stand out right off the bat. And that's before we even get started on the process.
That's right. Well, you know, our last guest, when he talked about selection, and you also talked about you guys didn't have a scoring system. You know, right. I kind of like a scoring system for multiple dogs. If I'm just looking for one, you know, I want to have a kind of a scoring system so I can go back and look at my notes and say, okay, this, you know, these are the dogs that I've chosen to move forward in the selection process. And so I think that's when it says to justify the cost, well, what are you buying to justify the cost? You know, the more training that the dog has, obviously it's going to cost you more money. But if you're talking about a green dog, I think exactly the first thing that I always like to do is look what you said. How are they environmentally? Take them to slick floor. It doesn't matter how good they do. If they can't go upstairs or walk across a slick floor or walk past a fan or loud noises, if I can't, I get that out of the way first. And if those are all good, then we'll look at, you know, prey drive, hunt drive, possession, and then we just build it from there.
In terms of whether these things are trained or genetic, obviously, I think most people would prefer that they be genetic, but the reality is that there are many activities that are trained. We've had this conversation before where, you know, you if you're going to buy a dog from a vendor in this country, most obviously want to present their dogs in a favorable light. And that's not to say that they're intentionally being deceptive. In fact, that's not doesn't mean they're being deceptive at all. They want to showcase the things that they know the dog is good at, that they also know that we know, they feel that we believe are desirable. So the way some people do that is that they set up stations and obviously they have, you know, practiced on those stations. And what I mean by that, it could be a large bottle pit. If you've ever, you know, folks have ever seen that, it could be a long, like a play sandbox filled with bottles. And you throw the ball in there and you have the dog go in and hunt for it. And the dogs that are really, you know, hard chargers, they just dive in it and bottles fly everywhere. And the dog works all that out. And then it could be a station where it could be a board and there's four corners that are attached to chains and it's real wobbly. So you're going to put a dog on that and you're going to see how he does. Up and down stairs, open stairs, metal stairs, all those things, you know, stairs the dogs can see through, sometimes throw them. But for the most part, if a dog is at this facility and he's been demoed or they have shown him to several people, he should be getting more proficient each time he does it, correct?
So, absolutely.
And also it gives the vendor an opportunity to see where some weaknesses might be that they can capitalize on, they can work on.
Well, I think if agencies are using the same vendors and they have a test they use, those vendors are training those tests if they're smart.
Sure. Right.
Sure. I agree.
Another dog selection question. Selecting a dog / import, what are the things that you're looking for and what are the deal breakers? Man, it leads right into this, a lot of the same things from the last question.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, for me, deal breaker immediately is environmentals. Poor environmentals and the dog is gone. Not going to spend time teaching a dog to walk on a slick floor. And because usually if they have some sort of environmental issue, it will show up again and again and again in different venues. You know, you go to a gym, walk across the floor, you get them going across concrete, but now wood floors or vinyl floors or a different texture sets them back again. And I think for me, that's if I'm buying a dog from somewhere this selection tested to be a police dog or even a protection dog, I'm passing because I'm not going to redo that every time I go to something new.
Of course, when you're working with, if you have your own dog, for instance, if you see a bobble, the important thing is what does the recovery time look like? First of all, is there recovery?
Yes.
Does the dog recover from it? The second being, how quickly does he recover from it? And what did it take to get him to recover from it? Did it take a lot of action on your part to stimulate him in prey, to get him motivated to get past it? Or does he just kind of, yeah, that's different, and then has a slight bobble and moves and finally moves forward? Two different ways to look at that. Definitely, in poor environmentals or bad environmentals are definitely deal breakers. And the other part is that is, and I, from my perspective, you shouldn't spend the kind of money that you're spending to have to work through something like that.
No, you know, again, if I've raised a puppy or bought a puppy, those are the things that I'm going to spend time working on as the puppy develops. And that's on my dime. And I completely get that. But if I'm going somewhere and I'm buying a $10,000 dog, that is not something I'm going to work on because that should have already been vetted as far as I'm concerned, or it shouldn't even be a police dog or a candidate to do that. Now, let's see here. All right. So have you ever selected a dog that you liked? Then after getting it, you saw some issues like conflict or redirecting on the handler. And if so, what was the solution to dealing with that? Or do you just select another dog?
That's a good question.
It is a great question.
It is comical. I think if during the selection process you see a dog that is redirecting on the handler, that's obviously that's a red flag. But also, in all fairness, what is the dog being asked to do? You know, I've told this story many times where we were at a particular vendor's and we were doing our tests, which really weren't very elaborate, but it was a hunt test, a test hunt drive. And we would take a ball, which very similar to what other people would do, and get the dog out. Of course, this is a dog that none of us know. And we throw the ball into the tall grass, might spin him around, disorient him a little bit, and then allow him to go into the tall grass to hunt for the ball. And obviously, what we're looking for is the dog that is going to be persistent and going to get to the ball quickly or fairly quickly and not give up, get the ball, bring it back. Of course, he doesn't necessarily have to bring it back because what's the incentive? But I remember a particular dog that the handler was saying that he sensed the dog was about to bite him. And he was. And that's ultimately what happened. But it rattled him pretty bad. But
sure.
Looking where we could probably do things a lot differently. Now we'd probably try to trick him with the ball, but we didn't know that was coming. But obviously we didn't select that dog.
Oh, absolutely. I don't think I would have selected him either. And I think you go back to you can see things during the selection test. You make sure you hit all these high points and be careful about what you're asking a dog to do in those moments because you have no relationship with the dog. You know, you're selecting a dog that you want to go out and work independently of you and do really hard things. And then, you know, if you get a little pushback in the beginning, you know, a lot of people say, oh, no, I don't want that dog. Well, you know, you're asking him to do some very difficult things independently without you sometimes. Right. You know, now if he's turn around trying to kill everybody, that's a different story. But getting a little pushback, I don't think for me that's going to be a deal breaker in the beginning, especially since you don't have a relationship.
Yeah, but, you know, I think any dog that we get, the possibility of conflict creeping in can present itself. And I think that, again, goes back to experience and training and knowing what typically causes conflict and being able to identify those signs in the dog that he is conflicted and he is being he's in a situation where he's either going to be amicable and relinquish whatever it is we're having conflict over, or he's going to man up and he's going to show you what he's really all about. And I think there are ways to minimize that. I saw you do this with a gentleman in Philadelphia on our first trip where the dog had redirected. I don't remember what agency, it's really not important, but we managed to get through several sessions where the dog remained focused on the decoy rather than spinning and redirecting on the handler. And those were, I think, they were really just some minor adjustments, but sometimes it takes somebody that's outside looking in and helping to identify those things and just making sure that everything is calm and working through them.
Yeah, because if your dog is spun up, like in this case, that dog was very spun up, and you add more excitement to it,
right,
then you get more spun upness, for the lack of a better term, right? So, and it can cause a lot of issues. And so by saying, hey, let's not do that. Let's keep them focused. Let's remove what we just did. And let's keep the dog focused on what he thinks is important. And the outcome went really well. So, and hopefully I didn't get to see him this past week. I'm hoping things are still going well for him. I know he did well during the e-collar class with Eric, which, you know, made me really excited for him because the guy, great handler, you know, a lot of people that would get bit on the foot like that would go put their dog up and not come back and train. And, you know, he was back in the training room, you know, 30 minutes later, which is, you know, kudos to him. Good guy.
Yep. Hey, guys, I need to let you all know that the Thin Blue Line Conference is now the Hold the Line Canine Conference. It's the same great annual conference run by the same great folks. The Hold the Line Canine Conference is a 3-day educational conference started by Joe Lukowski, who is an active canine handler with the Pocono Mountain Regional Police Department. It was started solely for law enforcement officers and military personnel. This year, it will be held on May 2nd through the 4th in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. They offer a variety of classes with an impressive instructor lineup, as well as an array of top-notch vendors. To ensure their attendees are up to date with the ins and outs of the canine industry, they are constantly making sure their class schedule reflects this. Some new instructors this year include Kenny Williams with Interdiction, Mike Nesbitt, Carlos Ramirez, Mike Lilly, and Steve White, to name a few. Attendee and vendor registration is now open, as well as a variety of sponsorship opportunities. Don't miss out on this amazing opportunity to have a great time with fellow brothers and sisters in blue, as well as to further educate yourself to keep you and your canine safe. Register at thinbluelineconference.com or htlk9.com. Also, follow them on Facebook and Instagram for continuous conference updates. What are your main goals with your dogs, and how far along are your dogs in the training when the handlers start school?
Well, you know, for my experience, I like to have some pre-training on the dog before I give it to a handler, especially a new handler. That way, you know, the dog understands odor a little bit. He's probably calm on the bite already, probably has a baseline of obedience, at least sitting and downing, before we start any school with a brand new handler. That's just my personal choice. That way the handler doesn't create any scars, doesn't screw up any timing, because you don't know what you don't know when you begin. You know, if it's a handler that's already had some experience and I can count on to have some decent timing, then, you know, then that training may not be as important as it is as if it's a new handler.
My arrangement is quite different, where we get dogs.
You're just spoiled, Howard Young. You're just spoiled.
Well, I am a little spoiled. I was, you know, because we're getting a dog that basically I selected, that, and he's going to a handler who doesn't really know anything. We're starting from square one, so there is no pre-training, but we have the luxury of time, and that's the beautiful part of it. And having done this for a few years, we kind of know what works, what doesn't work, and again, taking our time. So the education is really the training of the dog and also of the handler. I think there's some value in that too. And from the handler's perspective, is that he's getting to see a progression. And my job is to try to keep, not only keep things going the way they should, but also helping the handler understand that this is really fast, or, you know, this is a process that really takes time, and you may see very small improvements, but I can tell you right now, the dog that we're working, the latest dog we got, is just absolutely phenomenal. The way he's picked up detection, the way he's picked up tracking. I did a couple tracks for him last night. I did one track that had a large amount of asphalt on it, and that dog looked like an absolute rock star. I was amazed.
Well, it's always pretty when it works out that way, isn't it?
Absolutely.
All right. What do you feel is the most underestimated training advice you give handlers? Well, I know what mine is. I think leash handling, teaching handlers how to hold the leash, how to hold the leash while they're directing the dog. I think it's an art form that is kind of lost in translation sometimes. And I think that it's probably one of the most important things you teach handlers, not how to keep a tight leash, how to stay out of the dog's way. You know, because people will say, well, my dog works better off leash. Well, you don't get to do that out in traffic. You know, you got to have a dog on a leash. Or if you have, you don't own the area, you know, if there's potential problems that you have, the dog has to be on a leash. And you got to know how to do both. So for me, it's leash handling.
Well, I'm not going to disagree with that one. I see that the leash handling is vitally important, whether you were doing obedience, whether we're doing detection, whether we're doing any sort of aggression exercise. It's all vitally important, and it's a big communication tool that I don't think that people really realize, is that sometimes it has nothing to do with what you say, but what the dog feels.
You know, it's interesting that that question came up, because this week in Philly, I had the opportunity to teach some guys and girls some leash handling, and getting feedback afterwards, going back into their scenarios and seeing how it fixed problems right away just by changing the way you hold the leash and how you direct the dog, and how that issue went away. Almost, it was seamless with no conflict, which is even better.
Right. Yep. Allowing that dog to work freely, even though it's on lead.
Yes, sir. Well, because then, you know, if the dog can take direction with you on leash, when you cut the dog off leash, it still is able to take the same direction, because it's used to the things that you set up, the ritual that you create, just flows over into something else. And I think it just makes things so much easier.
Well, I love this next question, because I've been around a while and you have too. Old school versus newer dogs of today. How do you feel the dogs 10 years ago versus dogs of today? And the second part is having less or more nerve than backbone, and what is the washout rate from then till now? Well, one of the things I can do is I have the luxury of not just saying 10 years, but 20 and maybe 30, going back 30 years or 20 right. years. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think there's a couple of different problems that we have today. One is you don't see older dogs to buy. You know,
right.
used to be the 24-month-old dog, the two and a half-year-old dog you were getting that was mature, that you weren't going through some of the problems that young dogs had. They had more training from overseas or from the vendors. And then I think the second problem is that the internet has ruined the dog world. Mm-hmm. I think that everybody thinks they can do it. Everybody's selling dogs and they can't do it because they don't do it very well.
Right.
And I think that's what's two of our biggest problems that we had today. I don't think it's the difference between old school or newer dogs. I think they just had more training and they were more mature.
I think you hit the nail on the head for sure. Is that I don't really know, don't believe that there are really any, that the dogs are any different. It's just that they are younger. If we're looking at the dogs we're getting from overseas, they're most definitely younger. Going back, the upper end of where I would purchase a dog was around 3 years old. I didn't ever have to consider a dog really ever being too young. We didn't find any young dogs. They were always older.
Right.
And with the older dogs, obviously you're getting more maturity, more training time, whether it's, you know, the training time is really the kind of training that we're talking about, or it's just, you know, time doing the things that they know that we're going to want, which can create problems as well. But, you know, that again, I'm going back to that dog that we were working with right now, he's 14 months old. I mean, he's a baby. And we've had dogs that were much younger. Now, again, my situation is different that I've got time on my hands. You know, we may take 6 months. And in 6 months, that dog is going to be a different dog all the way around.
Absolutely. And you have that. You also have the experience to sit back and know that's what you're going to have to do.
Right.
Some of these folks, you know, especially here in Kentucky, you know, there are a lot of small agencies. They don't have trainers. You know, they're tasked with getting a dog. They come back to their agency after they get this dog and go through a little training, and they don't know where to go. And then they go somewhere in the state or try to seek out a trainer that doesn't understand the foundations that was used where they came from. The age of the dog is, they need 6 months, but their chief or sheriff says, we don't have 6 months. This dog's supposed to be on the street.
Right.
You know, and I think that's having the ability to be able to look at that, and you have those relationships that you've built where you can say that and it goes very well for you because you've done it so long and you have those relationships with your agencies.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is that you have to consider a 14-month-old dog. We've got all these tasks that the dog needs to learn. The things that are the most stressful are going to involve the bite work without a doubt, where you can put undue stress on a dog and obedience for that matter, unless you know how to do it more motivationally, which hopefully people learning how to do that versus the old yank and crank days and really putting pressure on dogs to do obedience. So when I'm looking at this 14-month-old dog, the lion's share of our time is really in detection and tracking and in obedience, motivational obedience, and knowing that we've got time for him to mature and that the more stressful things, and if you think about a dog maturing and becoming stronger mentally and physically, that the stressful things will come later. We do bite work, but we're doing a lot of prey motivated things and we're not picking dogs up and putting pressure on them. We're just building them. Build.
Right. And, you know, and that's where I think it comes when you don't have that time, that's where you're seeing dogs wash out because they don't understand that the dog needs time.
Yeah. Well, there's not a dog. Every dog you get is going to have a quirk.
Sure.
You may not say, oh, yeah, I remember when that dog did that. But every dog's going to have something that is just, you know, it's a bit of a quirk.
I agree. All right. This is a long one, Howard. Whew. All right. This may take the rest of our time here. It comes from a newer handler, 5 months. His partner is a single-purpose narcotics detection dog. He's mostly training with limited real-world deployments on the roadside. The last few shifts, we've been utilized several times, and when he's taken out of the car, I allow him to go potty before running the car. I put him into a sit before giving him the command to begin searching. Once given the command to begin searching, he does everything besides sniffing the offender's car. It's like he shows no interest in it at all and doesn't put his nose on the seams like he does in training when we run training cars. He's done this the last couple of times we've been called out on deployments, but we can leave the scene and go to a training vehicle and he's totally different dog and does as he should. So I don't know if it's distractions caused by the roadside traffic and other elements I haven't considered, but being new, I want to make sure it's not something I'm doing wrong first and then maybe getting some advice from more senior handlers. Thanks in advance for all your questions. Well, we hope we can give you some sage wisdom and we'll let Howard start with that one.
Oh, wow. I think this goes back to the whole, if we look at it and we keep talking about it, looking at pictures for dogs. And again, there's so many different ways to approach this. I think that in this case, it is quite likely that the dog does not see the actual, you know, the roadside search as something fun because that's just not been his experience. So there are different ways to address this. Is that obviously in training, this dog needs to experience situations that more resemble a real vehicle stop. And there are creative ways to do this. You know, I've asked guys that are particularly working night shift, you can pull up on a car that you know, or a car that belongs to a store, and you can light it up and you can have, you know, somebody else there with you, and you can make it appear as though it is a actual vehicle stop. Dog shouldn't know the difference. And for me, I would want that dog that he would come into odor. I would plant the odor very quickly. He comes into odor within the first 5 feet of that vehicle. And that would begin to paint a different picture and a different expectation that, you know, if the only fun that dog gets is the training vehicle that it trains on, and it needs to experience something that resembles more closely a real life situation and an experiences success.
Yes.
I mean, that's the way I would start that, but there's many facets to this question.
Yeah. And, you know, I look back as being a young handler, and I think you also have to be careful. And, you know, if he's using a body cam on his searches, he can go back and pull the footage and record yourself in training and then look and see when you're doing a real search, are you more stressed? Are you causing the dog to be anxious because you're different and you don't want the dog to fail because people are calling you for these real searches? Because, you know, admittedly, he's not done a lot of them. And so as police officers, we always want our dogs to be successful. We want people to use us, you know, and then on the flip side of that, other police are like, well, look, that dog can't find anything. And, you know, we talk crap about each other. So make sure that you're still staying light as well. Just like in training, you take the pressure off yourself. You go do a real search. Make sure you're not putting undue pressure on the dog because that can affect the dog's performance, especially if the dog is in tune with you, the handler.
Here at Working Dog Depot, we're pleased to make an extra special announcement. Fox and Hound Canine Foundation will be hosting their first celebration event with a fun-filled day meeting canine teams from across the country in an incredible atmosphere on Table Rock Lake in Branson, Missouri. On June 3rd, fun for the whole family will start at 12 noon. Included in the day of events are special canine demonstrations, raffles, a silent auction, vendor booths, balloon artists, live entertainment, and music. Later on in the evening, you're invited and encouraged to join in the gala event starting at 6. You can purchase an entire table or individual seating as you see fit. Enjoy an open bar, which will transition into a cash bar a little bit later in the evening. Also included are a silent auction, music, special private canine demonstrations, and VIP guest appearances. A detailed agenda will be forthcoming as the event date draws closer. We know that the folks at Fox and Hound, our title sponsor, have a huge heart for canines and their handlers. It's important to know that all proceeds that are raised by their fantastic Canine Foundation event go to assist canine teams by providing funding, equipment, supplies, paid canine medical expenses, canine handler education, and specialty training for active and retired canines. Don't miss out on this super opportunity to network, have some fun, and support a wonderful cause. We hope to see you there.
You know, you get some dogs. This past week, we saw some dogs that weren't in tune with anyone except the job at hand, right? They were ready to go, 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 go. And that's not always the case. So make sure you're not putting some stress on the dog that you shouldn't.
It does sound like he's got some good rituals that he uses.
Mm-hmm. He does.
You know, and those are things that would set the dog up for success in a real situation. Assuming he does everything the same. Yeah, it's lots of ways to address that one.
It is. And, you know, and I'll put it out there. I don't know. We don't have a name on this. But if you want to send us some videos, man, we'll take a look at it and try to help you any way we can. Yeah. We can reach out to Howard or I, either one, and just send us some videos. We'd love to help you if we can. Both training and life.
Absolutely. I think we got time for one more question. And it's a pretty simple one. How do you typically introduce muzzle fighting to a dog that hasn't before?
Okay. Well, I think for me, it starts off with, let's make sure the dog is conditioned to the muzzle itself, that he understands it's just a piece of equipment. Howard has done a really good job of discussing that on past podcasts. And I've heard him talk about it the last couple of weeks that, you know, we introduce the muzzle separately from before we put him in a fight. You know, make sure that he's comfortable wearing it. It's just a piece of equipment. He does obedience in it. He's done detection in it. And then we can look at muzzle fighting from there. That'd be how I would at least start to put some perspective behind the question.
Yeah, without a shadow of a doubt. You want to create a positive association with that muzzle, whether you use food or whether you put it on the dog and you allow him to push a soccer ball around, all kinds of ways to do that. But obviously a dog that is completely preoccupied with the muzzle and is trying to take it, scratch it off or knock it off, they're not going to get anything positive from it.
Well, you know, and as far as drilling it, you know, I like to, if I can, I like to use a few dogs in a circle and
sure.
Put a decoy in the center and, you know, have a couple of dogs that are good at it. Watch and let that dog see those dogs punching, get them excited, let them punch the decoy a few times. Have a great decoy that's going to overreact as far as, you know, you just killed me, great job, and making sure that dog wins and wins again. That's how I would.
I like doing that as well. I think the one thing to do, just to make note, is that make sure the dog isn't preoccupied with the other dogs.
Yes.
But sometimes you can take a dog that is a little bit dog aggressive, and if you put the decoy in the middle and they're opposing each other, that can alleviate some of that. Definitely would alleviate the side to side aggression. So
right.
You've basically have the decoy in between them and you can work around that a little bit.
I agree. And, you know, and if you can't, you can just post a dog and the decoy can use some prey and just get some muzzle punches that way, you know, again, big time overacting, letting the dog know that he's winning every time he hits you. That's a lot of times the muzzle, you'll keep pushing the dog back and the dog feels like he's losing. So I think that can become problematic.
Yeah, definitely role playing is huge.
Sure.
All right. I think that's going to wrap up our first Q&A.
Absolutely. And again, really appreciate everybody that, you know, took time out of their day to send us a question. We really appreciate that. Some good questions.
Thank you indeed.
All right. Great questions. Hopefully there was some value behind some of the answers we gave. And tonight, as we always end our sessions here, we're having a little larceny. I was fortunate enough this past week that Howard introduced me to larceny. I've never had it. Very tasty. And it's got kind of a cool story. So why don't you fill them in?
It does. I will say one of the reasons why I got larceny or why I like larceny is that it's easy for me to obtain. It is always on the shelves. So a little bit of the history. It began with a gentleman by the name of John E. Fitzgerald, who was a bonded U.S. Treasury agent who had access to the rick houses where bourbon barrels were stored and aged. His position gave him the means and opportunity to steal tastes of some of the best bourbon. See what they did there? Larceny?
Yeah. Larceny, steal, agent. I like
it. Yeah. So using his keys, Fitzgerald would let himself into the rick houses, thief bourbon from the best barrels, and take jugs of it home for himself.
That's a typical point. You can't give the keys. Clever.
So I think it's one of those bourbons. Again, is the price is right, easy to obtain. It'd be one of those bourbons well worth having, you know, in your bar. Now I haven't ever tried any of the upper end stuff, so I just get the typical small batch, which is easy to obtain.
Yeah, what was that? What that bottle cost?
Oh golly, it wasn't very much. It was it's definitely under $35.
Yeah, great price, good flavor, well worth putting on the bar. I agree,
for sure. Larceny, cool name, cool story.
Absolutely. Well, Howard, as always, here's to the hair of the dog that bit you. Good to see you, my friend.
Yep. Good to see you. Till next time.
Thanks so much, you guys, for following along, supporting us, and listening to these wonderful conversations that Howard and I are just blessed to have each and every day. We'd like to thank and support all of our first responders, police, fire, EMS, and our military for once again holding the line, keeping us safe. Stay safe, brothers and sisters. We love you. God bless, and God bless America.